I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast. These two topics. Let's start with the practice that we're doing right now, which is essentially a Mahamudra approach to Shamatha. Now, there's a lot of terminology that flies around in Buddhism, which I don't think is particularly helpful. Some of it's even traditional terminology, badly translated. What I'm thinking of here are things like shamatha with support and shamatha without support, or shamatha with an object, shamatha without an object, form meditation, formless meditation. Any of you heard any of these terms? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. People get wonderfully tied up in knots about them. The purpose, or what we're aiming for at this point, is cultivating a basis of attention. And for some people, that is more easily done if they use a reference point, such as the breath, or a actual object. And for other people, it's more easily done if they don't use an object. What's important here is to focus on is to keep the intention. And the intention is to cultivate a base of attention. Now, there's only one way to cultivate a base of attention, and that is to do something which requires some attention, doesn't require much thinking, and do it over and over again. And one can liken cultivating a base of attention to learning scales in music, or if you're using a wind instrument, learning how to blow the instrument, a nice even tone. Or if it's a string instrument, such as a violin, learning how to draw the bow. It's a basic skill. There's nothing particularly magical about it. And the way you learn, the way you do that, any of those things, is you just do them over and over again. Now, when you do them over and over again, you make tons and tons of errors. You know, you miss notes in the scales, or the bow wavers, or your breath isn't steady, or whatever. But when you're doing that, you don't regard that as a problem. You just say, okay, that's how that is. And then you do the next one. And little by little, things get better. Now, how many of you beat yourself up every time you fall off the breath? Or there you are sitting in open awareness and you fall out of it, and then you beat yourself up, right? How helpful is this beating yourself up? I'm going to send Ralph to Raton and ask him to get a good supply of baseball bats so that everybody, whenever they fall off the breath, they go bang, bang. Pardon?
I said gladly.
Many people approach meditation practice as they would approach SAT or a GMAT or something like that. They have this one chance to get it right. It's a practice. And the thing about a practice is you expect to fail. You don't expect to do it perfectly. And that's why you're practicing it, so you get better at it. How many of you approach meditation this way? Everybody's trying to do it right all the time. It's a practice. So you fall down, fall off the breath, fall out of attention, time and time again. So that's the first piece that I want to convey this evening. It is, approach this retreat as practice, and fall out of attention, okay? Start again. And you just do this again and again and again. And there's a saying in Chinese, to learn how to do something, do it 10,000 times. That's all. Don't worry about the first 10,000 times. After that, if things aren't coming together, then you can get a little concerned. But not for the first 10,000, okay? Something to keep in mind, because I suspect this operates in a few of you. Who are you trying to impress with your meditation practice? Janet? But you got to impress somebody, right?
Yeah.
Not quite sure who, but there's somebody there that's going to be impressed. I'm going to make sure that they're impressed with my meditation practice. So, you know, the nice thing about meditation practice is when you finish, nobody gives you a round of applause. And you think that this is funny, but this is how many people practice meditation. As if, you know, they're on stage, they've got to do it perfectly, and then when nobody gives them a round of applause, they're kind of miffed afterwards. Where's my recognition? Okay. So it's a practice. You're not going to impress anybody. The consequence of that is you can completely relax in this. You want the deep, dark secret here? You're the only person who's going to notice if you don't do it perfectly. Nobody else. But that's not how we approach it. Now, some of that comes from an idealism, a yearning for an ideal. This is also very problematic, and it's encouraged very, very highly in most Buddhist traditions. I mean, yeah, from the Zen tradition, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. And reactive emotions are infinite, I vow to release them all. The gates to the Dharma are infinite, I vow to enter them all. Awakenings are limitless. I vow to engage them all. Nothing idealistic. One of the things that we've lost in the West, and this is really, this died out about 100 years ago, is the use of formal language and mythic language in how we communicate with each other. The four vows that I just recited, which is the form the Bodhisattva vow takes in the Zen tradition, this is mythic language. It serves to inspire, to move emotionally, and you don't take it literally because it doesn't make any sense literally. We grow up in the culture, into modern culture, postmodern perhaps, in which the intellect, thanks to the likes of Descartes and others, was placed above reason, above emotion. To some extent, this goes back as far as Aristotle, but it really gained ascendancy in the what's now referred to as the Enlightenment, which it wasn't. But in which reason was seen to be the ideal, and this led to, you know, several generations of people repressing their emotions and so forth. And a lot of good came out of this in one sense, in that there was, and it came out of the development of the scientific method and the use of reason as applying to understanding the world. And when you're working scientifically, whether it's in medicine or physics or biology, whatever you read, whatever you write, you intend it to be taken absolutely literally, because you're trying to describe things very precisely. And when you read an account of a scientific experiment or a diagnosis of a disease or what have you, you read it absolutely literally. It's not poetry, it's not symbolic, it's not mythic or anything like that. And over what's now a few hundred years, this has been the primary way we relate to things. We've lost that to a large extent, being able to talk about things symbolically. Indirectly. And I had a very explicit experience of this when I was having a conversation along these lines with a psychologist. And he said, well, what do you mean, this mythic language? And I said, well, in Tibetan Buddhism, it says, regard your teacher as Buddha. And before I'd even finished the sentence, he said, so he's infallible, right? I said, perfect. That is the literal trap that you fall into. It doesn't at all mean that your teacher is infallible. That's taking it literally. what it means is that for whatever reason, you regard this particular person as how you experience awakened mind in the world. That's what it means. That's how you experience awakened mind. It's through this person that you come to learn and understand and come into connection with awakened mind. And that is one of the primary functions of the teacher, is to reveal awakening to the student. But that has nothing to do with infallibility. That's another projection, a modern projection on the notion of being awake. It's that you're perfect, like some kind of Superman. Thank you, Nietzsche. You see, this is where all of these ideas come, and they're laid on top of these traditional teachings.
So, you know, the Catholic doctrine in terms of the Pope and infallible.
Do you know when the Pope? Do you know when the doctrine of papal infallibility developed?
One of the councils.
Pardon?
20th century.
No. It was very late 1892.
Yeah.
1892. That was when it was became official doctrine. Mm-hmm. And it was a reaction to the ascent of science. They needed to have something which said, this is how it is. So it's not a traditional or an ancient view. It is a modern view. And it's a reaction to what was taking place in the culture. Okay. It's very important to know these things.
Well, coincides with what you're saying, the laws also mythic.
Exactly.
You know, current.
Yeah, because that was about the period where it was really largely lost. It's a pain in the neck for translating. You can't translate anything into High English anymore because it just sounds stupid. Because we don't use High English, formal language. The only place that is used at all is somewhat in diplomatic circles now. Okay. So, a lot of instruction in Buddhism is expressed in mythic language. I will give you one example. It happens to be a Mahamudra instruction. I thought I'd keep it on topic. Body like a mountain, breath like the wind, mind like the sky. Now, I think this is quite a good example. If I say body like a mountain, what do most of you think of immediately? Yeah. Okay. Now, what's it like meditating like that? Does it work? No. So is this what it means?
No.
No. So what does it mean? Nick?
It'd be very stable.
How do you become very stable? Can you just say, I'm going to be stable? Does that work?
That's a relaxed body.
What does that have to do with a mountain?
Mountains don't make any effort to sit there like that.
Exactly. Say it again loudly so we get it on there.
Sorry, I said mountains don't make any effort to sit like that.
Yeah. So this phrase, body like a mountain, means to sit without any effort whatsoever. And you come at this by actually just taking it in and letting it speak to you, not trying to analyze it and figure out exactly what it means, etc., etc. Okay. This is the language of poetry. And similar things with breath like the wind, mind like the sky. So, in what we work with in these days that we're here together, let the instruction sit in you let them reveal their meaning. You'll know when they've revealed their meaning by what happens in your practice. A lot of people think that shamatha means having no thoughts. Calm abiding means having no thoughts. And we find lots and lots of descriptions of states of mind in which there's very little thinking going on, or there's no thinking. How does that come about? Does it come about by trying to have no thoughts? Yes, we have a little experience in that. How does it come about?
It's in resting or exploring.
Pardon?
The resting works.
Yes. And that's why I'm emphasizing the resting. You notice I'm not emphasizing being quiet. And this is another thing that is worth noting. I make a moderately big deal of this and wake up to your life. When you are receiving instruction from anybody, and if any of you are in the position, ever in the position of giving instruction or guidance in meditation, pay very, very close attention to distinguishing method from results. What happens over time is that the distinction between these two is blurred. And there's definite reasons why this happens. Because all of you have some experience, I can talk in a kind of shorthand. And I can say, do this. And all of you already know how to do X. Where, properly speaking, X is the result of doing something else. So, if I were working with another group of people, I wouldn't say do X, because they don't have that experience to work with. I would have to say do Y, and then they experience the result X. For instance, if you say to someone who's a bit tense, relax, what happens? Yeah, why don't you just relax? Okay. That's an example of X. But if you say to the person, take a deep breath, let it out slowly, take another deep breath, let it out slowly, now take another deep breath and let it out slowly. How do you feel? They will usually say, oh, relaxed. Okay, that's the method. Now, when somebody knows how to do that, you can say, oh, okay, relax. And they will just go. They will just do what they know to be the method. This is one way that result and method get confused, because you have people with different levels of experience and ability and so forth. But it's extremely important when you're learning something for the first time and when you're teaching, is to make these distinctions. Because if you describe the results to people and people try to practice the results, they will get into a hell of a mess. So the method here is resting. As we rest, we create the conditions in which body and mind can grow quiet. But if we were to say, make your body and mind quiet, we'd have a lot of uptight people very quickly. Now, in the approach we're taking to resting, there are certain challenges. All of you are here, as we touched on Wednesday evening. Is that yesterday? No, it's 2 days ago. Good, I'm losing time. This is a good sign. Many of you said you're interested in deepening your experience or understanding of Maha Mudra. It is also important to keep in mind why we're interested in deepening our experience or understanding of Maha Mudra. And as I suggested, I think, on Wednesday, the primary reason, at least for me, is that in order to be able to meet what arises in experience in my life, it's become clear to me that whenever I'm attached to an identity or an idea of how things are meant to be, I will run into problems. I will either project onto the situation something that isn't there, or I will fail to notice or be aware of something that is there. In either case, my response to that situation is less than appropriate and creates difficulties for me, certainly, and usually for other people. It's helpful, perhaps, to remember that the end of suffering is not a state, but a process. We end suffering in each moment by responding appropriately to what arises. So, meditations or practices around direct awareness, of which Maha Mudra is one example, or one instance, are very useful because we are practicing experiencing and being present in experience without reference. This is not how we usually interact with the world. We're very, almost always, used to having a reference point. Several years ago, I was invited to participate in a yearly event that takes place in Pasadena. I'm not sure it still does. Because it's called a Day of Conversation. And the idea is to get people from all different walks of life to come together and just spend the day in a conversation around a certain topic, and they have a keynote speaker who sets up the topic. And then you're seated at tables of about 6 to 8 people. Well, the table that I was at, we didn't get very far into the topic. Because the facilitator asked everybody to introduce themselves. And I've obviously been hanging out in the wrong circles. Because I had no idea what to say, so I said, I'll pass. And then the next person gave their family history, going back two or three generations, and their life history. And the next person did the same thing. And went around the table. So this consumed, you know, an hour and a half by the time it got back to me. I didn't have a clue what to say. And I remember it very clearly because it's just like everything is defined by reference here. Right? Big time. This was old school Pasadena, so it was quite interesting. I think I ended up saying like something like, well, all of you people are have had very productive lives, worked within the context of institutions. By contrast, I've done everything I can not to have any role within any institution. So I'm feeling a little odd here. So, but I give that example of how deeply reference goes in our lives. So, the practice I've been giving you, and we're doing, continue that for another day or two, is learning how to rest without reference. That's one way of summing it up. Now, resting is hard enough. Resting without reference is like making it doubly difficult. Maybe triply difficult. Maybe quadruply difficult. Someone said yesterday, feels like I'm simultaneously grounded and falling. That's a very good description of resting without reference. The falling part is the no reference. The grounded part is the resting. Now, somebody sent me a cartoon which I really should have saved, a comic strip. It only had two frames. It had a picture of two guys and a bird and a dog. And they are in various postures of terror, like against a completely dark background. And the frame for that, or the caption for that frame reads, 3 minutes after falling into a bottomless abyss. The next one shows the two guys like this. The dog like this, and the bird like this. And the caption is, 6 months after. This is your practice. Why do we fear falling?
Means we don't exist.
Somebody else.
We're afraid to hit the ground.
Yeah, we believe there is a bottom. That's why we fear falling. We believe there is a bottom. Well, I'm not going to ask you to take this on faith. You'll have to find this out for yourself. there is no bottom. But you have to find that out for yourself. I'm sorry, I cannot. I can talk endlessly about it, but it doesn't do any good. You just have to find that out for yourself. Then you'll be able to relax. Okay? And rest. So you're going to have that reaction every time you actually rest without reference. Part of you is going to go, uh-oh, bad idea. Not good. Now, do you know what to do when that happens? Anybody?
Include it.
Pardon? Yes, that's right. Include it and rest in that experience. So you're going to rest in the experience of freaking out. Of different degrees of intensity, you know, anywhere on a scale from 0 to 10. I want to emphasize again, this is practice. So, this is another book that I've taught from, and it's a very, very good book on Mahamudra. It's called The Lamp of Mahamudra. It's been reprinted. Tsele Klatsok Rondro. It's okay. Lamp of Mahamudra, you'll find it. And the end of it is a little more theoretical than Dakpo Tashi Namgyal's book, but the body of the book is just really, really good. I have the Tibetan for this, and I spent a year teaching it to a group of people many, many years ago from the Tibetan, which is my favorite thing, because then I can just complain about translation endlessly. There are three instructions that are traditionally given in Mahamudra. I think I mentioned them the other night. You'll find different translations. One I'll use here is don't wander, don't control, don't work at anything. You'll more often find them translated as don't wander or don't be distracted. That one's fairly straightforward. No contrivance is the usual translation. But when I thought about, you know, contrivance, well, why do we make things contrived? Because we're trying to control our experience. So don't control, I find, works better. And the third one is no meditation, is the usual translation. But the word for meditation here is the word to become familiar with something. And that's why I translate it as don't work at anything. So, no distraction or no wandering, no control, no work. Now, when you hear these, you immediately feel or sense there's no reference. There's no reference point. And part of our being promptly goes into panic. How do I do this? When you were here 4 years ago, I was teaching a Dzogchen retreat. Dzogchen is very similar in this way. And one of the people at the retreat was getting more and more exasperated with the practice. So they had the wonderful meditation instruction, do nothing. And so during one of the interviews, she finally got so exasperated with me, she said, "I wish the hell you'd tell me how to do nothing. I don't know what to do." Then she hurt herself. Oh, shit. This is no reference. Okay? There's that part of us that just panics. Don't ignore it. That's what you're experiencing. If you're going to rest without reference, you're going to rest in whatever is arising. This isn't the case of making everything nice and quiet and then resting. This is, you don't have that reference point. It's not, first make everything quiet, then rest without reference. That isn't the instruction. It is rest. Let's go back to our friend the mountain. The mountain is there. Like, we have a very good example of a mountain right here. It's an old shield volcano. It's been built up by layers and layers of lava. In other words, it's solid rock, not like the one over there, which is a cinder cone. Now, it's pretty windy here, and you haven't really experienced how windy it can get, being relatively quiet. It's so windy here that whenever Gay wakes up and there's no wind, she goes, "What's wrong?" How much concern does the mountain give to the wind? Okay. How much concern do you give to the winds of your feelings when you're resting? So, this is another example of be like a mountain. Does the mountain ignore the wind?
No.
No, it feels the wind. And if you really want to feel the wind, climb up to the top. Mm-hmm. It's usually about three times as windy up there. It's really windy. But it feels the wind. It's not the least concerned about it. So just imagine resting like that. Now, these little breezes, maybe you have these gale force feelings. Can you rest right there? And remember our friends falling into the bottomless abyss at the same time, completely relaxed. You're getting the picture here? I mean, this is so unfamiliar to us. You know, we don't approach life this way. It's like, you've got to be kidding. But this is how you actually approach the practice. So that part of you that panics, that's wind. So just rest in that experience. And then another part of you panics at that prospect. And so it goes. Courtesy of Kurt Vonnegut. What happens, you see, is that we grasp for some reference point, some characteristic of our experience. We go, and try to hold on to that. That's why the first instruction is no distraction. Because that grasping is distraction. This is actually the first of the three gates of freedom. Three gates of freedom are the Mahayana equivalents of the three marks of existence. First mark of existence is impermanence. Mahayana equivalent, the gate of freedom, is no characteristics. We can translate that into our parlance as no reference points. And no distraction is how we practice no reference points. Then the second one. No control. How many of you tried to sit just right? The perfect posture. That's a big thing in Zen, right? Well, I've either been cursed or blessed, I'm never quite sure which. But I have a body which will just does not like the traditional meditation posture. So I've never been able to sit perfectly. So I could never practice Zen. Hopeless. They'd throw me out 15 minutes. 16 if it was a good day. We try to control our experience through how we hold the body, through how we breathe, through how we hold the mind. We're trying to control our experience. What if you just stop doing that? Well, you've got to approach this practically. If you just lie down, you go to sleep. Not much going on there. So you sit. But you sit in a way that allows you not to control your experience. It's a little different intention in sitting. It's not to sit perfectly still. It's to sit in a way in which the tendency or the need to control one's experience is diminished. Now, the traditional meditation posture in the Tibetan tradition, which you sit in lotus and lock your hands up like this, you have a meditation belt, is very, very definitely designed for precisely that. It's an extraordinarily strong posture. Because when you sit in that posture, all kinds of emotional stuff can arise, and you can just sit in it. It's that strong a posture. And the yogins of Tibet, that's why that posture was developed. It was originally developed in India. It's an extreme posture, but it was so that you could rest completely in experience without control. Now, I'm going to leave how you do that up to you individually. I'm very happy to talk about your efforts with that in our individual interactions. One of my students, Jeff Bickford, and some of you, Ralph knows, and a couple of others here know, is trained in Feldenkrais. And he's been doing some very interesting work applying that training to meditation and spiritual practice in general. And he wrote this small booklet, which, as you see, is Awareness Through Movement for Meditators. And it's very much about how to sit in a way in which you can be in your experience without control. And I'm rather struck by the quotation he put at the end from Moshe Feldenkrais, who was the person who developed all of this. The object of this learning is to remove outside authority from your inner life. So there are a few copies here, and I'd like to ask you a couple of ways so they happen for the second retreat. there's about 10 copies right up here. And you can look at those. What I'd like you to do is look them over, read them, find what's useful, then return it so somebody else can benefit from it. And if any of you want, I can put you in touch with Jeff. Actually, I think George has this, probably has it on a PDF too, so I can get, so you can get copies for yourself. But this is a way of just exploring through very, very subtle movement ways to be actually more completely in your body and more completely in your experience. Not trying to control it, just be in it. When time's going too quickly. How many of you have been in a situation where you struggled to control it and it just wasn't working and you had to give up? Okay? What was it like when you gave up trying to control it?
Relief.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Defeat.
It felt like defeat, yeah.
Sure. I guess for me, it's almost like seeing that it was so ridiculous to try to control it.
Mm-hmm. And what happened after you stopped trying to control?
Something else arises.
Yeah. Life goes on. And not always in a bad way. Sometimes in a very good way. So, remember this, you know, in your meditation practice. Maybe I actually don't have to control everything here. Ah. And again, this is very much about no reference. Because that's why we're trying to control, we're trying to hold things together. Now, this links with the second of the three gates. The second mark of existence is suffering. The second gate is usually translated as no aspiration. But I think we can put it into more Anglo-Saxon English and say hopeless. No hope. Yeah. It's a very good way to approach your meditation practice. There's no hope for it. Yeah, just gotta sit here and there's just no hope. You know, it just takes all the rugs away, doesn't it? No hope. And you stop trying to control, etc., etc. Because the reason we control things is we are hoping for a certain outcome. We want things to be a certain way. We hope. So this is why no control corresponds to the second one. Then the third instruction is don't work at anything. How many of you are concerned with being somebody? Very important to be somebody in today's world. You've got to have a story to tell. But it's all a fiction. When we look at what we actually are, all the stories run out like sand through our fingers. and we're left looking at absolutely nothing. One Zen teacher says, gain is illusion, loss is enlightenment. When you're looking at absolutely nothing, you're looking at what you actually are. There's something a little disconcerting about that, but that's how it is. This is what Buddha experienced at the time of his enlightenment. Mara comes along and said, who gives you the right to sit there? Well, this didn't make much of an impression on Buddha because he was experiencing not being anybody at that point. The idea of being given a right to sit there and be somebody just wasn't operating. And we practice meditation in order to develop, you know, want to have an understanding of emptiness. That's nice. Then I can go out and tell people I understand emptiness. Or compassion. I didn't bring the Heart Sutra, my Heart Sutra commentary. I have a line about this in there. So we're all working to develop the perfection of wisdom, right? What are you going to do with it? Show it off to your friends? We don't think about this. That's the stuff that operates in us. So here, this is, all of that working at things is about trying to be somebody. To stop. And be what we actually are. And that's another rug pulled out. So, this corresponds to the third mark of existence, which is non-self, of course. Mahayana equivalent is emptiness. That's actually practiced by not working in anything. Now, all that one does here is rest. And whatever arises in experience, you move into that experience and rest. So a thought arises. Move into the thought and rest. What happens to the thought when you do that?
Dissolves.
Yeah. Poof. Emotion arises. Anger or desire or jealousy. You move into the emotion and rest. It may not dissolve immediately. But remember, you don't move into it in order for it to dissolve, because then you're back into this business of hoping. You move into it, it's because it is what you're experiencing, period. So I'm angry. And all of this is in the... I can never remember which is which. Which is the... awareness, full awareness of breathing sutra, the Anapanasati. It's all in the Anapanasati sutra. It's very simple. When the monk is cold, a cold monk meditates. When the monk is hot, a hot monk meditates. That's just this instruction. Whatever experience arises, you move into that experience. That's it. It's all in those really basic sutras. And you just move into that experience and rest. Because that's what is right there. Sounds very simple, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we want to get something out of the meditation. Because that hungry ghost keeps creeping into our practice. And if it isn't a hungry ghost, then it's a god thing. But what a good boy I am. I don't know about you, but for me it's those two. The rest, they operate. You know, if I'm getting I'm having difficulty in my meditation, then I move into the hell realm. Then I go to sleep in the animal realm.
What happens in the human
realm? That's when I start getting blissed out. Oh, this is cool. I like this. I can work at this a little bit harder because that's not that good. And then I glance over the other person beside me. They're sitting so still, and I go, and I'm in the Titan room. That's my meditation practice. Okay. Now, the other topic I want to touch on is Guru Yoga. Actually, this is the better name for this topic would be Faith and Devotion. In Buddhism, we have two very different types of emotions. And they're so different that they aren't referred to by the same word at all. Whereas in English, the word emotions covers a whole range of things, so we actually use the same word. One type of emotion are the emotions that are organized around and defend a sense of self. These are ones you're all familiar with, the typical list in Tibetan, the six realms, so anger, greed, or neediness. I think neediness actually is a better translation for greed. Most people don't relate to being greedy, but a lot of people will relate to being needy. But it's the same thing. Animal realm, which is instinct or dullness. Desire, jealousy, or envy. And pride, being special. And those we call reactive emotions or emotional reactions, the translation of klesha or Tibetan nyumonpa. But then there's another kind of emotion. And these are emotions that are not organized around a sense of self. So I, with a little bit of irony, like to call them the impersonal emotions. They are loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Known in the Theravada tradition as the Brahma-Viharas, and in the Mahayana tradition as the immeasurables. We could add a fifth to these, fifth or sixth, and that's the devotion and faith. Because these also are not organized around a sense of self. I want to distinguish between faith and belief here. And this is pushing English a little, but I think it's an important distinction. I use the term belief as the attempt to interpret experience to conform to what's already inside, and faith as the willingness to open to whatever arises in experience. don't have a good definition of devotion, so I'm going to pass on that one. I'll have to think about that. Faith is extremely important in this practice. It's faith which gets you to jump into the bottomless abyss. You actually don't know that there's no bottom. But you jump. There's actually a very good reason why we jump. Does anybody know what it is?
Suffering.
That's close, yeah. We've all reached the point that there's no other alternative. Suffering. Nothing else looks good, so this is it. It's good to remember that. That's why you're here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the other alternatives, they don't look so good anymore. So just as you step off, you go, you know, that one didn't look so bad after all. It's too late at that point. Now, in Tibetan tradition, there are three kinds of faith. And they're usually presented in the order of simple, clear faith of appreciation, faith of longing, and faith of rational understanding. And probably because Tibetan Buddhism and Indian Buddhism before it were medieval institutions, they're presented in that order. I think the order is wrong when it comes to Vajrayana. Start with the other order. Start in the reverse. We study and it makes enough sense to us that we're inclined to have some confidence in it. This, interestingly enough, is connected with the first mark of existence. It's a little bit of this convoluted connection. You see, impermanence is the meditation for anger types. Yeah. Anger types really want things to be a certain way, and if they aren't, they get very angry about it. Impermanence is a very good remedy for anger types, because it's nice and rational and you can really reason it, and when you really work with impermanence, you see, it's not going to be the way you want it. You're going to die. Reason is the weapon anger types use when they do not want to acknowledge their anger.
What was the word? What did you say?
Reason.
Reason.
How many of you have had an emotional discussion with somebody and somebody resorts to reason? Okay. And it's perfect for anger types, because they don't have to acknowledge their anger. They can just say, well, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this. And it's completely ineffective in an emotional argument, because it's not about how things are, it's about connection. But they don't have to worry about any of that emotional stuff, because they can just sit and quite content and be perfectly right. They never have to actually embrace their emotion in the situation. Anger types do this all the time. It's very irritating. So if somebody pulls that on you, don't get into the argument. You say, this is how I feel. How are you going to relate to that? And that will drive them completely nuts. I don't care whether it's right or wrong. I don't care whether it makes sense. It's just how I feel. This is a good approach. So, we start having some confidence because things make sense. Out of that, there develops a yearning. I just like, gee, I'd like to move to that. I'd like to go in that direction. Which is very much what has brought all of you here too. That's the faith of yearning. It's a longing. It's heartfelt. It's deeper. It's much deeper than a rational appreciation. The heart longs for something. We may not be able to put it into words, but we can feel the longing. And as we let ourselves feel that longing, and some of us are very afraid to feel it, in the burnt offering, in the 7-point prayer, or the 7-section prayer, second last one. Uprooting patterned existence from its depths. Patterned existence is samsara. I pray. What this line is describing is letting yourself feel that longing so deeply that it makes chaos out of all of your habituated patterns. Reactive patterns, because that's what comprises samsara. It's a scary place to go to for a lot of people. For some people, it's actually quite an easy place to go to. This is connected with desire types, of course. But to feel that yearning so deeply that it completely messes up our habituated way of relating to life. That's what prayer consists of. Very, very powerful. And when you open that way and everything is disrupted, there's a kind of opening. And another kind of faith comes out, which is just an open appreciation. There's a lucidity and clarity. Nothing that you can put into words. It's not rational. It's not really clear that it's actually emotional in the ordinary sense of the word. Because there's almost a knowing in it. And that's what's called in Tibetan is a appreciative faith or a lucid faith. Yes,
I listened to your Mahamudra teachings and podcasts, and you were talking about the 9 levels of consciousness.
Oh, the 9, yeah.
And it struck me that, maybe you said it, but that devotion is where the emotional consciousness meets the pure consciousness.
There isn't, at least in that scheme, there isn't a pure consciousness.
Okay.
But I think you could say that's where the emotional mind, which is the 7th consciousness, meets how things are. Yeah. The nature of nature of experience, the nature of being. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you could say that.
Because it feels very naked.
It does. You're absolutely right. It feels very, very naked. Very raw.
Yeah.
And one feels frighteningly open. And there's some people for whom this is a totally natural path, and other people for whom this is a really, really difficult place to go. So, cultivating those kinds, all three kinds of faith, but leading up to that, just openness. That's a very important part of practice. It involves being able to open emotionally. This is why one of the reasons why I included the verses on the faith mind. Because it speaks to this. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Well, there it is, first two lines. Letting go of preferences. Just taking things absolutely as they are. It demands that kind of opening. And you can read for yourselves going on, but it's very, very much about opening to our experience in this way. Now, all of you have to some extent cultivated this, each in your own way. And I would encourage you to cultivate it. There are different ways. One of the ways that I encourage people to cultivate is to become very, very clear about what their own spiritual questions are. Not to simply accept the formulations we get in the Tibetan tradition or in other traditions, but really become very clear about what one's own spiritual questions are, because when you know what those are, then it's going to be very easy, much easier, to open to the path that they point to. And that's one approach. A traditional approach is guru yoga. Every tradition, every practice tradition, has what I call a repository of faith. In Zen tradition, Soto Zen particularly, the repository of faith is the posture. That's why they make such a big deal about the posture. Trust the posture. Called it a repository of trust too. Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition, it's the bell.
What?
Mindfulness bell. In Theravadan tradition, it's the Dhamma, the teachings. That's why they're always talking about the Dharma. Drives me nuts. In the Tibetan tradition, the repository of trust is your teacher. That's where you place your trust. It's where you place your faith. And he or she holds that. And if they don't, then you have a big problem, as many people experience, unfortunately. But that's one of the functions of the teacher, of the guru, in the traditional Tibetan approach, is that they are the repository of trust. And that links up, that's what I was saying right at the beginning, that you regard teacher as Buddha, which means it's how you connect with awakened mind. And so the practice of Guru Yoga is actually the cultivation of faith and devotion through that repository of trust. And the purpose of it is to develop a level of emotional engagement with one's practice, so that all of that emotional energy becomes available for attention. In the Theravadan tradition, this is done through loving kindness. The Mahayana tradition is done through compassion. And the Vajrayana is done through devotion. They're all ways of transforming emotional energy into attention. And they all have their pros and cons. What Guru Yoga consists of, there's usually some kind of, or you begin by imagining yourself in a form different from your own form, so you let go of all of those associations. It's usually one of the higher yidams, such as Vajrayogini or Chakrasamvara, but it could really be any. Or you could just imagine yourself as a bodhisattva or a figure of light. That's one element. The second element is you imagine your teacher in the form of an awakened one, a Buddha. In the Kagyu tradition, that's usually Vajradhara and Dorje Chung. In the Nyingma tradition, it's usually Guru Padmasambhava. If you have a deep relationship with your teacher, then you can imagine your teacher in his or her ordinary form. Rinpoche used to say, well, if you pray to me in my form, all you do is get the blessings of an old man. but I found for many people in the West that they actually, because we've lost the relationship with symbol, it's easier for them to develop faith and devotion, imagining people in their actual form rather than in a symbolic form. Then there's usually a section in which one acknowledges the role of lineage, unbroken line of transmission down from the time of Buddha. That's done in to greater or lesser length depending on the particular ritual being used. And there's sometimes additional acts of honoring, such as the seven section prayer and so forth. And then you start praying to your guru, in which you just open your heart in the ways that I've been describing. In the Kagyu tradition, a very short prayer is often used, it's Karmapa Chena, which means basically translate as Karmapa, think of me. Just think of me, Karmapa, think of me. And you say that over and over again. The prayer that I, Rinpoche had us do, which I formed a relationship with, is the one that I translated, that six-line prayer. Treasured teacher, I pray to you. Give me energy to be free from ego, fixation on self, and so forth. There's another prayer which is used in the Shangpa tradition in the Sukha City, Guru Yoga, where you'd imagine the Guru in the form of Sukha City. So you do that, and the purpose of repeating the prayer is just as a vehicle for you to open your heart. And through opening your heart, you develop this devotion, and that actually powers your practice. At the end of the period, then you take the four symbolic empowerments, imagining light of three different colors, white, red, and blue, coming from the forehead, throat, and heart of the teacher into yours. And then all three together. And you feel you're getting the traditional empowerments, the Vaz empowerment, the secret empowerment, Vaz empowerment, secret empowerment, the wisdom awareness empowerment, and the fourth empowerment. And these, again, are symbolic acts. And then you imagine that, you actually imagine is too weak a word, you feel that your guru dissolves into you, and your mind and the guru's mind become one. And Rinpoche explained this, it's like you have two rooms. You open the door, and now there's just one space. And through this, and then you just rest, do your Mahamudra practice. Through this development of emotional energy, and your attention is deeper, so you're less distracted and less disturbed by what arises, and more capable of, or have more ability, capacity to open to whatever arises in experience without being disturbed or distracted. And eventually that becomes so deep that you move into the experience of being no thing, which is awakening. This is one method of transforming energy into attention. One of the reasons I gave you the primary practice yesterday is that it is another method for transforming energy into attention. Here the transformation process is a little different. You start by transforming the energy of sensory sensations, and then the energy of emotions, the internal material. Again, you have that opening to the heart, which boosts the opening. And this is it's a cumulative process of transforming the energy of the experience of all aspects of life into attention, which then powers our practice. There are other methods. There are methods of qigong and internal qigong, such as the microcosmic and macrocosmic orbits, and in the Tibetan tradition you have very high power levels of energy transformations and tumo and so forth. These transform the energies of the body, and as such are inherently dangerous. If you get out of balance with those, you get sick, and any medicine in the world that will cure you. I know this from my own experience, because I did get seriously out of balance, and it's taken me something over 20 years to heal that. It can be quite difficult, so one has to be quite careful with those. Only if you're going to go in that direction, make sure you learn them from someone who knows how they work, and you stay in touch with them until you're quite well trained in them, because there are lots of things that can go wrong and you can get really screwed up, as lots of people have. But they're also very powerful and very effective. So I think I've covered everything I wanted to this evening. Too much? Somebody sent me an email the other day saying there's a couple who wanted to come to this retreat, but things didn't work out for them. So I read your book, it's a little encyclopedic. I guess that's your style. I'm also going over your Heart Sutra class, the one I did on the internet. It's a little encyclopedic too. Sorry, that's what you signed on. Okay, to review very briefly. Oops, I've gone longer. Oh, I told you. That's strange. 2 minutes ago, it was 8:11. Now it's 8:26. Resting without reference. You're going to fall forever. Get used to it. You know, and that's a very good way to approach practice, is you're just going to fall. Forget about doing it right. Just do it. And use whatever methods you're familiar with from your own practice, so that you have the sense of opening to whatever arises in experience. Don't try to control what arises. Don't work at anything. This is why I'm putting such emphasis on this quality of resting. If you're using any of the energy transformation methods, in particular the primary practice, Guru Yoga, you're going to be alternating between pushing and resting. When you're opening to all the sensory sensations, you're pushing a bit. There's an exercise of power in that. But once it opens and you're there, stop and just rest in it. Don't keep pushing. this becomes extremely important when we move into the practice of Vipassana, knowing when to stop and just rest. It's the same with Guru Yoga. You pour your heart out in the prayer, and there's definitely some pushing there. When you really pour your heart out, it gets scary inside because you're so open. And then when the Guru dissolves into you, you just rest. And all kinds of stuff may be there that wasn't there before because you're able to experience it now. And you just experience it. You just fall. And you fall forever. So that's the thumbnail version of tonight. Okay? So let's just take a very short break to stretch and come back for meditation. It's 8:28. Let's go. Let's just take that.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.